Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. Hey there, welcome. Andrew Horowitz here. The Disciplined Investor Podcast is what you're listening to, episode number 156. It is the middle of April. It's the beginning of earnings season coming along. Lots going on with Europe and poor Poland with the situation there. We have a lot of things to talk about today. I have five or six different things that are right on my top of my list. We're going to talk about the deficit. We're going to talk about Poland. We're going to talk about Greece, earnings season, some ideas on what's going on there, the S&P 500. Talk about Alcoa to kick off earnings season and what happened last week with them. We're going to talk about a couple of ideas I have and a real interesting thesis that you want to pay attention to when it comes to the state budgets and what they may do to actually earn themselves out, we'll call it, of their financial crisis. And we're going to do that through a couple of interesting stock ideas that I have. And maybe even we're going to get to talking about the yuan, the Chinese currency, the renminbi. And I always get that tongue twisted. I can't say. You know what? I had a friend that couldn't say the word Mitsubishi. Every time they tried to say the word Mitsubishi, they would say Mitsubishi. I said, come on, just say Mitsubishi. No, Mitsubishi. It was like, all right, let's put it on a piece of paper and get you over this problem here. And I have that same problem when it comes to the Chinese currency. And a lot of other people have problems with the Chinese currency. Not quite the inability to say the name, but anyway. A couple things I want to talk about. We're going to get right into this discussion. We're not going to have a guest today because we have so much to talk about. And you probably want to take out a pen and a piece of paper to write some of the things down that are going on today, because I'm going to give you a couple of good ideas, I think. And also talk about some things you need to be aware of when it comes to the markets over the next quarter. So we're going to pay attention to that discussion. So first of all, I'll mention thank you so much for all you following me on Twitter. It's been a lot of fun, and we're going to continue to do our best to provide you some great updates. You know, you get the first updates there if you want to follow me on Twitter. It's Andrew Horowitz, one word. Of course, I want to mention DH Unplugged. We had a great discussion last week about all sorts of wonderful things that John Dvorak and myself talk about. The Winning Investor, 5 minutes of discussion on market issues like earnings per share, trend lines, market capitalization. You want to learn the basics about the markets, go check out the Winning Investor podcast, available on iTunes, and it's on the Quick and Dirty Tips Network. And finally, I just mentioned this, that every once in a while I get some emails from people saying, where is this, where is that? There is a place on our website where if you want to find out more about our management, in other words, we manage money for people. Yes, that's what we do. If you like the ideas that we've talked about and you're thinking, hey, I want to try to get back into this market, but I don't want to get killed. So many people said, I don't know, is it good timing or not? We don't care which way it goes. You know, we're trying to make money in any market condition through our various different strategies that we have here. $50,000 minimum for the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. And if you're interested in that, I want you to go over right now and go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go to the show notes or just on the right side where it says check out the 14-minute virtual tour. There's a kind of a blue graphic there. And check that out, and we'll send you the information and give you some information that you need to know on getting started with that. All right, so let's start with a discussion about the deficit. And if this isn't going to get you really pissed off, I don't know what is. So in writing our quarterly commentary that we give to our clients, it's an economic commentary and outlook and review, We looked at the current deficit. I was just kind of toying around with some of the numbers here. And check this out. I want you to listen to this. So the current deficit's about $1.5 trillion for the U.S. And, you know, this uses a round number. And we're going to make some assumptions here. We're going to say that there is going to be a 4% interest rate on average to pay that back. If we had to pay that back, we're going to assume a 10-year timetable to kind of pay that back if we could. So what I did was, for the fun of it, ran a simple loan amortization schedule to find out, all right, what is that going to actually cost? So on a monthly payment, we have to do about $15 billion per month over the next 10 years in order to pay this off. We have total interest payment about $322 billion and a total payment about $1.8 trillion. Now, here's where it gets kind of fun. If we assume that there's about 316 million people that live inside the United States, and that's every man, woman, and child that's counted by the last census, and remember a couple things. That's not every taxpayer. Only 47% of the current people that live within the United States are actually paying taxes, it seems. And that's actually a report that was put out this week because of the current tax structure and the nature of the deductions and the rates and the levels, et cetera. If you look at that, and of course you consider the fact that we have this much people out there, well, we're looking at a payment of about $576 per year per person for the next 10 years. It's kind of a personal assessment, folks, to pay off this debt. And that's just the debt we've accumulated recently. It assumes that we have no other debt issues. It assumes that the cost of healthcare and everything else is going to either stay the same or at least balance out. Do you think that's really the case, though? The way this government is spending money on everything, I mean, they're expanding the unemployment again, the unemployment insurance, and for every kind of downturn, there's some money being shoved left or right using TARP questionably in the most recent way that is against what was actually written for TARP, and nobody seemed to, you know, scrutinize that too much because we like the money coming from the government. We don't care right now because we're pushing this off into the future. And we've had on some people recently, don't forget we had on just a couple of weeks ago, John Malden, who was talking about what he was going to be writing his children and what he's going to be saying to them. And I got to tell you something. It's a pretty sad letter that has to go out in the information. You know, dear sons and daughters, this is to inform you that we have spent all of your money and you will be indebted to the United States government over the next 25 years at a reasonable rate of $500 to $800 per person per month in order to pay for the debt. And, of course, that's on top of the usual taxes that you're going to pay on your income. That's to just pay back the debt in order to bring our balance sheet in order. I mean, something of that nature, right? Kind of crazy, kind of scary, kind of crappy. But nonetheless, this is you know, what's happening right now. And what do you think this is going to mean? I mean, let's get down to the brass tacks of this. Let's get to the fact that $576 per year per person is a number that when you look at the 316 million. Now, that doesn't consider the fact that, really think about it for a second, you know, it's really going to be spread over a lot less people. Over the 316 million, how many people really are going to be paying that back in taxes, et cetera? So when you think about it, it's probably closer to a couple thousand dollars per person, you know, per person that's going to be actually paying taxes. And that's even worse, obviously. But yes, your taxes are going to go up. My taxes are going to go up. We know that. It has to be. It's kind of the part of the plan. It's the hangover from the party we had over the last number of years. The question is going to be, that is the debt level going to be paid back? And maybe we'll keep some on. I mean, we do run this deficit over time. There was a few years there that we had a surplus. But okay, it's okay to run a deficit for a reasonable period of time, for a reasonable amount of money. This is bordering on the absurd, as you all know. And, you know, there's a lot of people, the Peter Schiff's of the world, and there's Mish, and all these. I mean, they're just blasting the government for the spending techniques they have. But, you know, what choice do we have right now on the other hand? You know, did we want to see this reset that everybody talks about and this horrible condition pan out where things just went to hell in a handbasket? I don't really know. I don't think so. Let's skip over. Let's talk about Poland. Just for a moment, what a horrible tragedy. I got to tell you something. When I saw that, first of all, I didn't understand. Did you understand why all of the officials that were ranked so highly in the Polish government were on one plane traveling to one? I mean, I don't think we would do that. I don't really know if most countries would actually allow for those high-ranking officials to all be flying on one plane. We're talking about the head of the Navy, the Army, the military, their equivalent of Ben Bernanke, the president, the first lady, and just a host of other important government officials were on that flight. And it is going to be a real problem for Poland. They have a reasonable succession plan. But what's going to happen is, obviously, that they're going to be in a bit of a disarray, and there's going to be this uncertainty that's going to go on. And that's the standard, you know, recipe for concern in a country. I would not be surprised if you see major moves in that stock market when it reopens. There's been some word about whether or not Poland is going to actually open up their stock markets or have a period of mourning. And we'll have to see what that is. There's not many plays that you can make on that. You know, not that we really want to, you know, benefit and profit on misery, but, you know, there is a Polish ETF or the Poland ETF that you should probably take a look at. I think the symbol that you want, just watch it. Just take a look at this is PLND, PLND. Now realize that Poland has been one of the standouts in the European zone and one of the countries that has escaped from recession last year. And it has a real good growth trend and all. But the bottom line here is going to be, you know, what's going to happen moving forward with the unity of the government and with the succession plan. So, you know, obviously this situation doesn't necessarily, you know, change anything fundamentally from Poland's overall economic situation, unless there is someone who, you know, wants to change something that comes into office. But right now, the equivalent of the Speaker of the House is going to take over. There's a period that they have to announce an election in 2 weeks, and I think they have 60 days to do an actual election. So hopefully they'll do it a lot faster than that. But the question is going to be, you know, who is going to be brought to the level where it was and to, you know, inspire the country to continue on after this horrible tragedy. So there'll be a lot of bumpiness there, and I wouldn't be surprised if over the period of time of the next few weeks there is a tremendous amount of volatility. Now, that ETF I mentioned to you is very, very low volume and can have excessive volatility. If you are thinking about buying that maybe on some of the weakness because you want to, you know, you believe that maybe the opportunity is there for Poland to be a really good player, I want to give you a couple of words of advice. The first thing is, and probably the most important thing is, do not, I'll give it one more time, do not put in a market order when you're buying this. You know, do not put in a market order, for example, at 8:30 in the morning, 9 o'clock. You know, for the open, I want to buy 100 shares of this. Because what happens here is that it is thinly traded. And even though it is an ETF, and oftentimes ETFs are a little bit more liquid, and, you know, you don't have the same market making going on, et cetera, oftentimes, you know, you may get hit with a very bad pricing print, and you can't do much about that. You want to put in limit orders. You may be saying, well, you know, it's, you know, give an example, $25. And I want to pick this up at no more than $25.20 or whatever the number is. And, you know, you could do something like that. But don't put in a market order. Don't, you know, that could be very, very disastrous with a very thinly traded issue. I don't mind this as a thinly traded issue only because, you know, it is an ETF versus a stock that is as thin as this. And it is supposed to be tracking the Poland stock market. So, you know, you could think about if this does see a significant dip over the next few weeks. Maybe there is some buying opportunity here, and you know, obviously, just keep on your toes with it because anything can happen here. And realize there will be intraday volatility because of the thin nature of that. I think it, you know, trades 7,000 shares a day. But look back in February on a chart, and you'll see that it traded about, you know, 110, 120,000 shares, and it was down. That was a day that it was down like 7 or 8%. I don't even think there was any significant news there. But if somebody's looking to bail out of this thing, it can really drop it down significantly, just like with any stock, you know, but look what the end result was a few days later there, you know. So just keep on your toes for opportunities on this. Okay, let's skip ahead now and let's talk about Greece, one of my favorite topics. I gotta tell you, you must think that I'm a lunatic when it comes to this, but it is kind of a fascinating topic if you think about it. A country default of this nature inside the EU. I mean, it's unprecedented, obviously. In this circumstance, it is a country and an economy within an economy, and different than a country's economy that's in the world economy. This is actually almost, in a way, in a small way, the equivalent of a state, or at least we can look at it as similar to a state. Whereas, you know, if a state fails, what happens? Well, there's a backing by the government. Now, what happened is that we talked about this last week with Rob Parenteau. And if you haven't listened to that podcast, I really suggest that you go back to episode number 156 and check it out, because he talked about how this is probably going to be some kind of a rescue. There's going to be a lot of backstopping done. And then we're going to have to wait till the summer to see a little bit more action on the other side, because it's not going to be a permanent fix. Well, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of rhetoric back and forth. We've seen Greece say, oh, we're not asking for any bailout. We're not asking for any help. Meanwhile, this constant talk with the IMF, with Germany, with France, you know, the euro gets smashed because there's uncertainty. It comes back dramatically when there's a comment. We had two or three times last week when France's Sarkozy, he said, oh, you know, we're not going to let the euro slide, and it's going to be, you know, we're not worried about, and there is no chance of default by Greece. On the other hand, we saw Germany start talking about all sorts of things like, hey, we are not going to supply any below market rate loans to Greece, period, because they didn't want to be in opposition of the basic treaty, the Maastricht Treaty that was put into place back in, I don't know, 10 years ago, which said that basically, summarizing this, that you can't bail out a member nation. It's just not allowed, because obviously if there's one currency and one economy, a bailout of a nation from an internal nation is obviously just money from pocket left to pocket right. And who's that going to help, and what's that going to do for the currency? It keeps it, you know, in a significant dilemma here. So when you look at the Greece situation, where it's now termed not a bazooka that came in to help late on Sunday, but it was a nuclear reaction. $60 billion worth of bailout funds that are available for the tapping by Greece if they need it. Part of that will come from the EU nations, and part of that will come from the IMF at about 5.5%, about 2.5% lower than the rate that the market is currently pegging on Greek bonds, about 1.5%, I believe it is, higher than the German bunds. But the reality is that this is a stopgap. It is a way to scare the hell out of anybody that's shorted the euro, shorted Greek bonds. Because now what's going to happen here is that Greek bonds are essentially going to have like an AMBAC insurance against them, you know, against the potential of default. Well, if worse comes to worse, they can come and run to Papa Bear and come to the EU, come to IMF as some kind of a backstop and get the funds from there. So there is really no worry about the potential for failure. Now, obviously, we have to see, you know, what the requirements are for Greece. But I got to tell you something. When this happened, even though, you know, the Greek Prime Minister said that he was not looking for anything, he doesn't want anything, he's not involved in these discussions, he's not asking, his comment was pretty much to the point of, now you can see there's no messing with the euro, you know, do not play games. I think his comment was, do not play games, nobody should be playing games with the common currency of the eurozone. Look at this backing. This shows the solidarity of the European Union to the long-term nature of the eurozone and the euro. Now, realize that this is setting up a precedent for Spain, for Portugal, and other countries that are having problems, because obviously this is kind of like a gigantic tarp, it seems to me. Now, think of it. This amount of money that's being put up, this $60 billion, is far more than Greece needs under the short-term period, which is about $20 to $30 billion to roll over their debt and to refinance it. At the rate of about 7.5%, it was too much, and we talked about this to death, but the bottom line is this is going to give continuing problems to the euro currency. In the meantime, we have to look at what the relationship to the dollar and to metals and to other commodities is. You know, right now, oil is trading in the area of 85-ish and hit as high as 87. And what happens now if we see a continuing weakening of the dollar for some reason? You know, if we see that the euro starts to rise and other currencies rise, and we've been seeing that, are we going to see $90 or $100 oil in the near future by this summertime? Is it possible? Stockpiles don't say they should see that. We looked at that continually. Inventory data is not at all showing a bullish sentiment when it comes to that. But at the same time, you're seeing the same situation we saw a couple of years back. You're seeing just the outright buying and the thought that oil is going to continue to go up because of demand. I mean, in China, the recovery situation. And basically, we're starting out, I would say, at a worst case now than we were then back 2 years ago. Because if you consider where the dollar is and where the currencies are trading comparatively to where oil is right now, we could be shooting through, you know, $100 very shortly if this runs out of control. Kind of a scary situation there. But that's the reality of what we're doing. But I think that would be a very big problem and have to come into control. And I think the most government bodies would take a look at that and say, you know what, that's going to pretty much derail any recovery that was going on. So, you know, I think that's a consideration when it comes to this. Now, Greece is going to be a concern. It's going to be back burner for a little while. There's going to be other things that pop up out of nowhere, like the situation in Poland. Crazy things just out of nowhere that are going to upset the global apple cart, if you will. That doesn't mean it's going to throw a monkey wrench into any rallies or not, or any recovery or not right now. But it's going to, you know, it puts a little bit of hamper and a little bit of a question mark. And we'll see what happens with the Eurozone, because I do look at some of the economic indicators. Germany looks pretty strong. But I tell you something, England looks awful, folks. Just awful. Debt-ridden. You know, right now there's some discussion by Soros saying that there's going to be a continued requirement for a devaluation of the pound for some time to come. Their debt is just a monstrosity. Not that ours is much better, but their debt is a monstrosity. It's going to be a heavyweight on their country for a very long time to come. And when you look at the Eurozone in total, you know, you are seeing a bit of a slowdown. Have you noticed the last couple of reports that are out? Confidence is up, but some of the basic reports are showing a slight downtick in the trend here. So we'll have to keep a watch on that and see if maybe some of the concern about, the heavy debt loads over there and the euro and the debt with Greece put any kind of a hamper on the overall progression of the economic recovery. I would say that, you know, if you were to ask me which area is probably my least area on the likelihood of a very significant economic recovery from this point forward, it would have to be the developed markets of Europe. There's no question about that. The problems that they have at this point of the recovery are almost, you know, difficult at best, even if it was in a very strong part of the, you know, even if you were in an extremely strong position right now. But it's looking like their position is going to get weaker and weaker and weaker. And, you know, as an aging country, aging area, where they have, mostly services, most of the countries now, not really a country that has materials and manufacturing, and for the most part, of course, Germany being one of the outsiders. I don't know. I just it seems to me there's plenty of opportunities elsewhere to build up some opportunity. Earnings season is coming into play, and boy, do we have lots to talk about there. I want to focus on Alcoa just for a moment. You know, next week we have Alcoa, and I believe we have Bank of America, J.P. Morgan. I think Intel's next week also. You know, it's the first week, rah-rah, woo-hoo. After hours on Monday, depends on when you're listening to this, we're going to figure that this was totally wrong or totally right. Alcoa came down. It was downgraded by J.P. Morgan at the end of the week. It was also downgraded by a couple of other companies last week. It's interesting because what I've seen is that, you know, we saw this gigantic rally into earnings season this time. The last couple of times that we saw the earnings seasons come upon us, we saw a move down in markets generally into earnings season over the last, I would say, 3 weeks prior. And then when the joy and jubilation of earnings came in, well, the markets moved up very, very much. And I think that what happened is now we're seeing that people are trying to get in advance of this, and we'll see how that plays out. But Alcoa, let's focus on this for a second. And I want to look at what's going on here from this trend, and then we're going to focus in on all of the trends on the S&P 500 as just a good place to look for what analysts are expecting moving forward and what has actually happened. So JP Morgan downgraded and removed the Alcoa from their focus list. Stock dropped, probably close to 8% or so over the last number of days. Their target was lowered from 21 down to 16.50. Now listen to this. 2010 EPS, earnings per share, $1.10, knocked down to 74 cents. Pretty significant, 25% reduction or so. Okay. They said that lower aluminum costs are going to hurt them throughout 2010, and they have an expiration of actually some accounting benefits that were put into effect there. Right now, Alcoa is cut to the bone in terms of expenses. And the only thing that would be driving the stock price right now, obviously, would be, you know, top line growth and the drop down to earnings. The problem is now that aluminum costs are staying very low. Now, we know from PPI that generally speaking, while metal prices have been moving higher and some of the energy prices have been moving higher, generally, and food has been stagnant. By the way, have you seen sugar? Did we talk about this? I don't know if we talked about this. Sugar is down like 50% this year, 2010. 4 months, 50%. Take a look at a chart of sugar. Pretty staggering. It was at a 25-year high just before that. But, I mean, wow. There's some crazy stuff going on in the sugar markets. Back to Alcoa. So we got 8 buys on analysts in total. nine holds and three sells on the stock. So that's by analysts, according to what we track here. And here's what we're looking for, and this is what I want you to look for when it comes to the earnings announcement. A couple of things. First of all, take a look at a chart just for a moment and look at the last few earnings announcements of Alcoa. Each one of them, there was a gigantic pop on the stock after the earnings, and then a gigantic move down and a trend down afterwards. Okay? I wonder if there is a lot less expectation on the stock right now. You know, almost like, you know, you think about the general contrarian nature of what investors do sometimes. Well, right now, I don't think they're very excited about getting their butts kicked after what happened over the last number of earnings announcements. Yeah, Alcoa obviously is up a lot from its low point. I mean, tremendously. But at the same time, look at what's happened over the trends of these earnings. I think there's a lot of disappointment there. Alcoa, again, just can cut so much expenses. And, you know, with aluminum prices falling and or at least stagnating through 2010, that's a problem. The sales are going to be about $5.2 billion for the quarter. Watch for that. Consensus is looking for about 9 cents per share overall. Again, I told you that J.P. Morgan knocked them down. I think they're looking for 4 cents. But the consensus is about 9 cents. Now, let me tell you something. If they do not come in somewhere in the nature of about $5.2 billion or so, and they're looking for about 5.27 for the following quarter, you're going to see a real problem here. You know, watch U.S. Steel, watch Alcoa, watch the various companies in the entire material sector for their reaction, because they'll probably react very similarly. But, you know, Alcoa is, you would think, there's a company that should be doing a lot better with the recovery and inventory restocking cycle. You know, the car companies are doing a bit better, selling a little bit more here and there. Boeing is obviously getting better orders in, and albeit from a low, but still many are doing much better. Question remains, though, you know, are we going to see this growth moving forward? So I think that, you know, watch this on Monday night. You know, you have these key numbers from Intel and Alcoa and Bank of America, J.P. Morgan. The banks have been on fire, by the way, and we're seeing upgrades all over the place. You know, everything seems to be fixed at this point. And everybody seems to be want to hop on the road and back on, you know, even though, you know, Citibank went up and down 50% and back up about 50% this year already. And Bank of America has been all over the place. We saw JP Morgan and Goldman just really rocking down throughout February, March. And then all of a sudden, the last 3 weeks have just been moving up dramatically. But we'll see what happens with that. And we'll kind of track that for you. But I want to share with you what we look at. And I'll put some of these charts on the website. And I want you to look at this. These are actually tables that we're going to snag from Bloomberg. What I want to talk to you about is the whole idea of what's happened, what's expected to happen, and what we're going to do about that. And we're going to talk in terms of the overall index, because it gives us a flavor for general market trend. You know, and the first thing we're going to look at is, okay, what happened last quarter in terms of growth, earnings, surprises? And I'll go through this, you know, try not to throw all these numbers at you to confuse you here, because they can begin, I think, become a bit overwhelming. But if we look at the S&P 500 x the financials, I like to exclude the financials because they're all over the place right now, up and down, and they're an important part. 17% of the S&P is made up of financials. But right now, just for this first part of this discussion, we're going to look at the S&P 500 x financials. We're going to talk about the fact that last quarter, the EPS, we saw growth overall of about 15.8%. Okay? Positive growth companies in terms of the EPS were about 256. Negative growth, 148. There were surprises. Overall, we had about an 8.7% overall surprise on EPS, earnings per share. Again, bottom line. That can come from a lot of ways. Cost cutting can come from, hopefully, better top line. We'll get to that in a second, though. Positive surprises were 330. Negative surprise, about 86. Is out of 421 companies. The other, of course, are the financials. The best performing group in terms of growth were the materials company, second to a consumer discretionary, which was interesting. Now remember, this is year-over-year growth, year-over-year. So consider that we're dealing with a year ago. Do you remember what happened a year ago? It was bad. So we're looking at numbers that are the first real significant level of 1 year since the very low, or close to the very low. And we're seeing numbers that are pretty astounding. Why? Because if you look at the numbers prior to that, if you look at the two quarters ago, the numbers were horrible. The year-over-year numbers were absolutely abysmal. But the surprises came, and again, the consumer discretionary, we had about a 17% surprise, materials 12%. Telecommunication services really did not do well, you know, the AT&T Sprints, et cetera. Utilities were kind of flat. Information technology did great, 16% surprises. And overall, companies did a good job of managing their earnings, the bottom line. They actually came through with some really good numbers in terms of analyst beats, which, again, analysts really weren't expecting a lot, it seemed, in terms of the growth of, you know, the growth of earnings and the EPS. The bar was set kind of low. A little bit different this quarter. They've raised a lot. You know, we've seen a lot of raises going on. We see a lot of target prices being moved up, earnings moving up. Here's what we have on. Now, let's shift over to the S&P. Looking at now on a sales basis, okay? So let me kind of get that. I want to share that with you. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we saw was that on a let me just see what I can find here. Bear with me 1 second. I have so many pages in front of me here. Okay, on a sales basis. Okay, now this is the whole S&P 500 here for a moment. And we're looking at next quarter. The quarter that's coming right in a couple of days, right? Next 3 months. We're going to see that industrials are still lagging. There's only going to be about a growth in sales, a top line of about 1% or so. The best top line seems to be, once again, on a year-over-year basis, in energy, materials, information technology. And according to most analysts, the growth trend is really pretty much peaking out here. We troughed out, of course, four quarters ago. And this is that one comparison from almost the low. The low was really about 2 quarters ago. But what you see here is that over the next, the next 6 quarters, normalization of growth is going to happen. Actually, we're going to see on the entire S&P 500, including the financials, that growth is going to be slowing down and getting more normalized and actually going from about an average of about 10%. Down to about a 4 or 4.5% growth rate on earnings. Now that obviously is a big tell right there that analysts don't expect a tremendous amount of top line growth over time. Now at the same time, when we're looking at EPS for a moment here, just EPS now, analysts are showing that this is pretty amazing that, you know, in the next quarter we're going to see a 31% increase year over year on EPS overall between all stocks in the universe, including financials, which are obviously a tremendous part of this because they're going to see a 73% year over year after they weren't making any money. But after that, inclusive of the financials, because the financials really slow down very quickly after this quarter on EPS, we're seeing the growth trend drop off from about close to a 40% down to about a 12% growth rate over the next 4 quarters. And that's interesting because, again, we're using these the fourth quarter, 4 quarters ago, was the low point when we consider all of the earnings inclusive of the S&P 500, not just the financials. Now, when we're looking at the EPS, where do we want to focus in? It looks to me that when we see the next quarter and we look at EPS growth, the estimates really are over the next 4 or 5 quarters that the material sector is going to have the greatest growth. Again, we've seen about 126% growth rate on EPS from last quarter, this quarter. That's pretty good. And when you look at the, let me just kind of pick up something here. So when you look at this EPS versus sales now, you know, of course, that the differential there and the growth is because of the cut in the labor force and the revamping of the operations, if you will. And one of the things that's going to happen is if we see more employees come back on, it's going to kind of hurt the EPS a little bit. But okay, that's fine. We're not seeing anything really dramatic here. But materials are showing, I'm just going to read across here, 126, 188. 126 was this quarter, 188 next quarter, 118 and 50. Earnings estimate growth over the next several quarters. Consumer discretionary is showing an 87% increase year over year, then 35. Information technology, 52, 47. Telecommunication is just a dog. They're just not seeing any growth. As a matter of fact, they're seeing a slowdown, which is probably representative of what has actually happened with the stocks being pretty much stagnant in that sector to down. But we're seeing that quarter one estimates are down 4%, then down 6%. Utilities are just going nowhere, although they seem to be the ones that will be playing the best probably in a quarter from now. If you look at utilities, they haven't been doing much. Their earnings pressure because of pricing, lack of pricing opportunity, is really been really held down very dramatically. So I want you to take a look at this. Go to the website and use it for your own view of what's going to be happening and what is going to be the hot sectors over the next several quarters and where you can possibly put some money to work and make some money for yourselves. I think there's a really good look at the overall sector by sector, look at this. And they'll make those available for you on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just go to the show notes from this particular show. Okay? All right. What else do we want to talk about? All right. Let's talk about just for a moment. Let's see what I have down here. Okay. Let's talk about a thesis I have here. You know, one of the things that has been happening over the last several years due to this, this downward moving revenue cycle for states because property values are down, people are out of work, there is less spending, but at the same time, they keep on spending. Less spending by individuals that can be taxed, but more spending by the state governments. I mean, they do not seem to ever want to reduce down their budgets. I mean, if you haven't noticed that by now, budgets don't seem to ever be cut when it comes to government. And that's a lesson that they're not learning very well. And what's going to happen is they just issue more debt. States are issuing a tremendous amount of debt. And, that's rolling over very quickly. Some of the states, their ratings aren't so wonderful. So they're having to use the Build America bonds and go the taxable route. And, you know, even so, we're still seeing that because nothing fails, of course, that bonds are being issued pretty well. Well, here comes the real question. Will they be able to continue playing this game where they get less revenue, spend more, and be able to issue bonds? I guess so. I mean, this government doesn't seem to want anybody to, to fail and has a terrible taste for any of that, and they just will keep spending money, and so will the states. They know that. The states really got the message that they're not going to be worried about things. But at the same time, it seems to me that they really do have significant budget holes that need to be filled. The question is, how will they do that? Are they going to raise taxes on your homes? Well, for the most part, a lot of people aren't in homes right now. Here's an interesting stat for you. Right now, I think that Bank of America is foreclosing on, 4,000 or 5,000 homes per month or something of that nature. And due to some of the backlog of what's going on and some of the things that have happened within their system and the amount of houses that they need to get off the books, I guess they're going to start foreclosing, this is what they said, on 45,000 homes per month through the end of 2010. That is remarkable. Probably have to make sure that's the correct number, but that's the number that I, we're going to kind of shift over to the internet for a second and see if we can find that in the background here. But what's happening is that, there's going to be a tremendous amount of houses on the market. And, we question whether that's going to drive down prices. I don't know. Is it? Maybe. Let's see if this is on here, if I have any news on this. Let's see. It's somewhere here. There's somewhere of a number of about... there's going to be some dramatic number coming to market very, very soon. And just look that up. You'll see it. It's somewhere around, I think it's 25. Here we go, right here. Found it. Okay, here's the story. This is on, where do we find this on? This is on Oregon Live, but it's probably just a news clip from somewhere else. Bank of America, which currently forecloses on 7,500 homes every month, we'll see that number rise to 45,000 by December 2010. As one senior executive pointed out in a recent trade show. However, a spokesman said he could not confirm that. J.P. Morgan expects the amount of real estate-owned properties in its portfolios to reach about 33,000 to 45,000 in quarter four. By comparison, they had at 23. Fannie and Freddie also are predicting a foreclosure spurt. Let's see. Let's see. They're predicting that they have 86,000 properties in inventory at the end of 2009. The number has grown and more than doubled from 33,000. And they said that is going to be dramatically increasing over the next number of months. They're going to have to push these things into foreclosure and kind of, I guess, get this thing under wraps here because they're holding all these things and they want to kind of get rid of them. Not a fun situation. But that's going to be happening, and you see a lot more foreclosure. So people who are looking to get some bargains, it's possible that there is some benefit there. So, you know, take a look at that. In the meantime, I still think that there's another option for the states. We are seeing this, and we're seeing a lot of discussion about this. We're seeing a lot of movement on this. And what is it? Casino gaming. The legalization of paramutuals and gaming throughout the states. And, you know, it's really going to be a function of which states move the quickest that don't have it now, because once you get to a point and you saturate the market, it's not going to be beneficial for anyone. Now, at the same time, there's going to be a lot of this discussion about, oh, you know, it's morally reprehensible and we don't want to have gambling in our state and, you know, we can't have this. But at the same time, they could do things that are morally reprehensible, like spending all the excess money on things that aren't necessary and blowing the pensions. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that this is a great opportunity for them if they play their cards right. So, no, I didn't mean to say that truly, but that works for this discussion, okay? So, there's no roll of the dice to do this. But anyway, here's what I think. Now, what I think is that they can do a couple of things. States will have a real problem if they want to try to go it alone. They can go the whole, Indian reservation route if they want, a lot easier. But who's going to benefit from this? Well, it could be some of the big names that come into the states. They could open up casinos, and I wouldn't think that's really going to be their game right now. You know, the Wynn, Las Vegas Sands, and the others. I think that what you want to look for is companies that make the picks and shovels for the casino gaming industry. Casino gaming industry has shown a slight uptick recently. Out of just last week, there was an announcement out of Las Vegas that casino gaming industry is seeing a little bit of uptick in players and in revenue. And, you know, they're going to start to do a little bit of a refresh on their games. Some of the things that we have in mind, for example, in the States, the first thing they'll put in, if they do put something in, is things like, very simply, the you know, they're going to put in lottery terminals. They'll put in one-armed bandits. They'll put the video pokers. They'll put all the various gaming devices in. Maybe not immediately. Maybe not immediately the table games like blackjack and craps and all that. They may have poker rooms. They may have a variety of slot machines that either are linked and play against each player, because there's some rules whether you play against the house or the player. But it seems to me pretty logical that the opportunity here is very large. So two companies we want to look at, there's a few of them out there, but two companies we want to look at that may pick up some opportunity. First is probably the most logical. We've had this before. It's WMS Industries, the manufacturer of video and mechanical real spinning gaming machines, video lottery terminals, etc. Not a greatly large company. We'll call it about a mid-cap, $2.6 billion capitalization. Average share volume is only about a million or so per day. And let me tell you, though, that this stock's earnings have been beautiful. EPS growth since March of 2008 has been pretty much steady to growing. It's slowing down a little bit, but generally speaking, you know, everything has slowed down. Sales have been in the double digits until about March of 2009, then they slowed down, but they never went negative. Never went negative. And in fact, they never lost money, you know, looking back, how long am I looking back? A year and a half here. So that's a pretty interesting situation there. Very little debt, about 19% overall. Funds own about 36%. Funds are growing. Institutional sponsorship is growing. EPS growth rate over the next 5 years expected to be about 40% per year. Over on average, over the next number of years. EPS estimates are about 186 per share this year, and then going to 225 next year, about 20% growth right there in those two periods. Being bought pretty well in terms of volume pressure. The trend looks nice right now in terms of an uptrend. We're seeing a little bit of a drop off this year. It was high as about 50, dropped down to about 37 right now, trading about 44. So, you know, something to think about. A company that has, it seems to be, their overall sales are doing well. They may come into much greater demand overall. And I think there's a great opportunity here for a game in this industry, or a company in this industry. The other one that I want to share with you is a company a long time ago. We invested in this company. We stayed away, fortunately, for it, with it for a while because the stock went down to about $2, okay? New CEO came in, cleaned up the act a little bit, and it's been on the rise from about $2 to about $8. There's a company called ShuffleMaster. Now, here's what they do, what I like about them. Again, they're involved in the casino gaming industry, and what they do is they specialize in efficiency. They specialize in making sure that there's shuffling machines that are actively shuffling cards, for example, whether it's poker, whether it's three-card poker, whether it's blackjack, or, you know, take your pick of the various games. And they have a couple things going for them. First thing is that, you know, if you're a casino, the downtime of the dealer is when you don't make any money. Dealer theft is a problem. Dealer cheating is a problem. Well, here's a couple of things that you can actually do. Number one, you can get an automatic shuffler. You can have a continuous shuffling machine that definitely benefits the house, by the way. I don't know, any of you gamblers out there know you don't want to usually play the continuous shuffling machine where you have six or seven decks inside of a machine and it keeps on shuffling and spitting out a random card from that constantly. Can't really get a feel for the game and et cetera. You know what I'm talking about. Well, they have those. They also have the seven-deck shufflers. Or six-deck shufflers, whatever you're choosing, two-deck shufflers. They automatically shuffle, so they're ready for the dealer when they need them, fully shuffled in a very clean fashion. Okay, great. That's pretty neat. They also have the ability to create a variety of games. They own games. So, for example, if you ever played three-card poker, they own the royalties for that, and the casinos pay for the royalties on the games that are played on that table. So there's a lot of things that they have that help out casinos. The other thing that they have is a brand new product. And this product is a virtual/live/interactive machine. Now envision this for a second. You go to the casino, you go to a blackjack table, you have a dealer there, they're dealing for you, they're dealing for everybody at the table. But let's kind of step back. Pretend that dealer back there is a giant screen that is a dealer of choice, a man or woman, and that dealer is virtual. They're dealing cards, no cheating, perfect at speed, and can interact with you. At any given time, they don't have to take a break, okay? There's no shuffling required, and this really benefits the casino. Players like it because hopefully if there's not any kind of rigging of the system to benefit the house in any indirect way, there's total randomness of it, that's a good thing. In addition to that, what's nice about it, if you want to change up the game, if you want to actually go and, let's say, change the table, maybe to a three-card poker, change the dealer at any given time, since it is computerized, you can do so. This is a great addition because now not only do you eliminate the speed issue, the break issue, the problem with dealer cheating, but you know what else you'd eliminate? You eliminate the dealer. Now, I am not one for, you know, taking anybody out of their job, but if this is the trend that's going on with companies, ShuffleMaster really can benefit here by putting these into places that maybe can have this as an alternative. So maybe some of these states that want to bring in gaming, but they want to do it light. They want to only have a few machines here. They can buy this machine and basically let it run on automatic pilot. And, you know, this is kind of an interesting little way of really playing out the whole idea of total efficiency of the gaming market. Again, when it comes to the tables, the trick is to play as many hands as possible, to have the odds in the favor of the house as best as possible, so total randomness. The more random, the better when it comes to the rules with, let's say, blackjack. And at the same time, to prevent dealer cheating and to slow down and to eliminate some of the costs of the dealers and of the people that are in the casino. So there's a lot of benefits here amongst the other products that we could see some benefit. Now, this will be a choppy stock. It trades about, on average, about 500,000 shares per day. Market capitalization is about $500 million. Small cap. A lot of short interest on here, about 4.5 days overall to short ratio. It has a little bit of debt, about 59% debt. It is a little bit questionable. Their cash flow has been very choppy. Their earnings have been very choppy. You know, they much more resemble what the casino industry and gaming industry look like rather than WMS, by the way. So this is kind of a different play. This is much more of a speculative play. This is much more of a longer-term play. If they do start moving up, you know, you can easily see this at about a 20% appreciation point. And, you know, they have to get past 10. Once they get past 10, I got to tell you something. It's a kind of a smooth ride up to 15 again or so, and possibly even higher, you know, considering the fact that if we do see the overall casinos replacing and building and trying to create efficiency, you know, that would be a good thing. Fund and institutional ownership is growing a bit. But again, be careful of this, kind of, you know, scale into this and scale into the other stock I mentioned here, because I think that, you know, they could, you know, they can be very volatile. And obviously the leisure gaming industry is one that also, you know, has some volatility to it. Well, we covered a lot of stuff today, a lot of interesting facts, hopefully some ideas for you. By the way, if you haven't got my book yet, go check it out over at Amazon.com, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. It's like $15 or something like that. Other than that, we'll be back next week. We have some great guests lined up for the next few weeks, and I think you'll enjoy them very much. We have, we have some people that we're talking about stocks, markets. We're going to have some specialists coming in about the retail industry. We've got a whole host of people coming in. The usual gang, too. Frank Kersey will be back soon. And John Markman we're going to have on. So we should have some interesting discussions to come. Check out the site. We'll put up all this information. We'll put up some of the charts as well. And if you have any questions, you know where to find me over here at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This is Andrew Horowitz. I thank you so much for listening, for tuning in, for making us a place that you trust. And I want to thank you for your friendship. As always, I want to wish you a wonderful week. Be safe and make some money. Go out and do some things that are going to be profitable for you in a disciplined fashion. Thanks again for joining us. Episode number 156 is all done. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.